Welcome to Choosing Better, conversations about wacky ideas, economics, and the art of living well. Take three, Tim. Take three, but we made it through the intro.
We did. So, Enoch, haven't seen you for a week. How was
whole
your
week?
How was your
whole
weekend?
Week. It was good. Week. We went to Guanajuato. It's a beautiful, beautiful city. Alyssa actually studied there as an undergrad, so it's kind of fun to bring students to her old place of study in a. Learned a lot of history. It's an important spot for the independence of Mexico way back 1810. It's a lot of history. We visited an ex-hacienda. Absolutely gorgeous and also horrifying to think of the way some people were treated. And
I don't know what that is, by the way.
So an ex-hacienda?
Maybe every listener.
Oh, things like Southern Plantation. There's different kinds of haciendas, but they're kind of like the central hub of the family that owns the area. Essentially, and this was a mining hacienda, so they also used it to kind of I'm not sure the English word, but for trying to refine the metals. So they would mostly silver, so they had this huge pool to try to extract the silver, and they used mercury. The workers had to use mercury to extract the silver from the rock, other kinds of rock. But there's also just tons of different gardens. So they had gardens in the style of Japan and gardens in the style of Rome and gardens in the style of Greece and gardens. So they just
opulent.
Have all these. So like when you read novels and they're like, would you like to take a jaunt through our garden? Now I kind of know what they're talking about. It's just gorgeous gardens that kind of stretch on. And like, how could anyone own this all? Yeah.
So now it's not like a public display, like owned by trust or what?
Now, it's an ex-hacienda, so it's a museum, and you can go visit it for
an ex-hacienda. Okay, an ex-hacienda, so former.
Okay. That's right.
Okay, we heard ex-hacienda. I was like, I'm not sure what an ex-hacienda is. Okay, that's a former, no longer operating hacienda.
No longer hacienda.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. Wow.
Yeah.
So
it was a great trip. How about you? How's your week?
Good.
You did some travels yourself?
We went to the Isle of Skye off season, which meant we had the whole place to ourselves, kind of, more or less. So my exciting story, we got a car for our whole time here.
Okay.
And it's a manual.
Okay.
Learned how to drive manual through videos and through being here.
Wait, you've never driven a manual before this trip?
Once. Wow. Once, and my brother blames me for destroying his transmission. So,
transmission. Oof.
Yeah.
Oof.
Anyway, so I'm driving.
How'd it go?
We've had it this whole time, so things are going really well. I'm getting...
Okay.
Yeah, I've had this... Yeah, we've had it since we...
Well, you got it to an island? How do you get to the island?
Oh, there's a bridge.
Helicopter drop?
That's a fun fact for you.
Okay.
It was, at one point, the most expensive bridge per foot in the world by toll.
So
the Isle of Skye had a bunch of Scottish and Island of Britain mainlanders buy second homes there, and they got sick and tired of...
Paying across the bridge every time.
No, the ferry. No, there's a ferry all the time.
And they were
not used
it,
to ferry life. The actual residents of Skye, the Highlanders.
Ferry,
the Highlanders,
what kind of ferry life?
Like, they're used to ferry life. I mean, when we were there, just there.
Like flying ferries?
F-E-R-R-Y.
Boring ferries.
F-A-I-R-Y. Boring ferries, that's right.
Not F-A-I. No, I think in British, it's not F-A-I
either. It's F-A-E-R. I don't know how to do it in Britain. There's a... You probably know. Anyway... So the people in the Skye were tired of the ferries, and so they lobbied really hard for a bridge to be built. A private company built the bridge, but never said what the toll would be. The toll was like, I can't remember. I think it's like £6 per way per car. It's not a very long bridge. It's actually the distance between the Isle and mainland is quite short.
Bring back the ferry.
Yeah. So people then, and then the people of Skye threw a fit. And so the first acts of the Scottish Parliament, because the Scottish Parliament was not really reconvened or reestablished until 1999, one of the first things they did was to nationalize the Skye Bridge to the liberation.
Okay, so now what was your cost?
Well, I guess my
fuel free.
Tax. It's free. I mean, free, okay. Quotes, free. But when we were there, we were desperately trying to find lunch because everything's closed. It's off season. You know, all B&Bs had, no vacancy signs up. So eventually we end up in a little tiny little port town of Wig, so it's called, and we go to the one restaurant in town called the Anchorage Cafe, family owned. There's kids running around. It's delightful, and that whole menu. And I said, okay, Alan, what do you want? Alan goes, I think I want the cheeseburger. And the guy goes, ooh, all we have is fish and chips. And he goes, but they're on special. Started laughing so hard. He looked at me, I think somewhat quizzical, because I was like, yeah, of course they're on special. That's all we have. And he was like, we've got lots of it. It's freshly caught right out there. And he goes, sorry, the shipment's been delayed. We were delayed by a week. I was like, that's the island life, right? There's delayed by a week. Anyway, so we're in Skye. drive my manual car back to Edinburgh, we decided to stop through Loch Ness because my kids were like, we want to see Loch Ness. I'm like,
hey, all right, got to.
So we tour Castle, we get back into the parking lot. My car won't start. It's like, oh. Then I go around and ask everyone in the parking lot for jumper cables. And 15 people consecutively say they don't have any, which leads me skeptical. I know. I was like, are us Americans just overly prepared with jumper cables? Also, I learned that they're called booster cables or cable leads, how people would say.
So did they have booster cables and not jumper cables?
Well, eventually I found a guy who had booster cables, and he helped me, but I couldn't start it. I was like, oh, man, that's bad.
It wasn't the battery.
The equivalent
of battery.
AAA showed up. It's called AA. By the way, I kept calling it AA. I said, AA's right. On the way. And eventually a Scottish guy went, yo, we don't call it AA here. It's just AA. And I was like,
it's just AA. That could be confusing.
We call that alcoholics anonymous, my friend.
Yes.
Yeah. Well,
roadside assistant. You know, you want them to be ex-alcoholics if they're going to be helping you.
Exactly.
If it was just that would be a problem. If it was just A, then you'd be in trouble.
Listeners, beware. If you're in a country and the roadside assistant says A,
AAA is good. It's not AA, sure, but AA. AA is okay.
So
A, no thanks.
He comes. He's like, your starter doesn't work, I don't think. But I'm gonna bump start your car. So we get it rolling. He gets in the second gear and he's like, okay, you have to take it to garage immediately. And I was like, but I'm 4 hours from Edinburgh. And he's like, he was like, can you drive this stick without stalling it to Edinburgh? And I was like, sir, I have never driven this stick car without stalling it, but I'm going to give it a go. And so the pressure's on. The kids were like, I have to go to the bathroom. I'm like, we're not stopping.
Nope. Get out the bottle.
Every time we came to a red light, because of course, you know, it took us a long time to get in the highway. And every time we came to a red light, my wife came sitting there and she's like, kids, pray. Get the Jesus kiss.
So, We cannot stop.
We made it. We rolled
good
in.
Good job, Tim.
We
That's like
rolled
the final
in
test. You passed the test.
Yeah, we did. We rolled that neutral. We also, Kim was calling ahead to all these different garages. But the internet's great. It's great. And we're looking up garages on the outskirts of Edinburgh. We're off the highway. So like, also, the city traffic in Edinburgh, like hills, traffic. I mean, by the way, steep hills, traffic, lights, the whole works. I was like, no, we can't do this. So we roll in to a mechanic. We said that we could overnight park and stop the car. The car would not turn back on. It's like, that's it. We did it. Mission accomplished. And by the grace of God, right there, by the mechanic, was a Papa John's. And my kids
were
like, there's no more Papa John's in Scotland? Yeah, they're like, this is amazing. So we got some Papa John's. We hopped on a bus. Boom. Good to go.
Life is good.
Anyway,
LG.
Life is good. Life is good. So we celebrated and we praised the Lord for a successful, safe delivery of a car to a mechanic. There we go.
Delivery. We pray for delivery of many things.
Yes, we do.
Delivery of pizza, delivery of cars, delivery of babies, you name it.
Well, today's topic has nothing to do with cars breaking down or manual transmissions.
Well, maybe. You can learn about it.
It's education. That's right. Education. And in particular, what we should prioritize when we're designing education systems.
Yeah.
So not just like
this is an interesting one. Thinking about it has been very interesting. I'm pumped.
You're pumped.
I'm pumped. I'm excited. Pumped. I even prepared trivia, and you are the trivia man. I was so excited I prepared trivia, Tim.
Today at lunch, I actually brought it up to a master student in theology. I don't think she liked it. But I said, you know, actually she on her own said, you know, in Sweden, this wild thing with the Swedish government will pay your tuition, whatever school you want to go to, just follows you. I'm like, that's called vouchers. And she was like, what is this wild idea? I'm like, it's called vouchers. It's quite contentious. And then I said, then I started talking about the Swiss model and how it's like, you know, unfortunately, they don't even allow homeschooling because you have to like socialize a Swiss student. And she's like, that's awful. And I was like, it's Swiss.
It's a perspective.
So let's talk about education. But Enoch, you have trivia for me. What a gift.
Yeah. You're welcome, Tim.
I'm ready for it.
All right, should I go first? You want me to go first?
Yeah, I will reciprocate with a gift to you. It's a gift. Nice. Giving.
I'm excited to receive
my gift.
It's a
white elephant.
Gift. Okay. Oh, is that a clue to the answer? All right, Tim.
No,
Tim, focus of education. What is the most popular degree for college degree in India.
India. So like India. A 4-year degree?
College degree. That's all I got.
Okay. So tertiary education, the most popular degree. I'm going to say computer programming.
Oh, that is the most popular degree in the U.S.
Oh, in the U.S.?
You were close.
So
yeah,
like business, just computer science in general?
Computer science, yes.
Okay. Okay,
but not in India. Not in India. It'll make sense.
I'm going to say it's agricultural economics.
Incorrect. Way off. You were close the first time. Not really. You weren't close the first time.
I'm going to say tech. So I'm going to say a medical technical assistant.
No. You want me to tell you?
Yeah, I do.
There's a couple in the area that have the same major as the most popular major. English.
Oh.
Like makes
sense. English language.
The English language.
Like not literature, but like English.
It's English. The language English. Of English.
The language.
Very practical.
But not like
very
Shakespeare.
Practical.
Yeah, very practical.
In fact, has everything to do with the point of today's talk. What is the point of education or the purpose of education or what should be the priority of education? And they're following global trends. But in their context, in the context of India, English is very, very practical, employable.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fascinating. I wonder to what extent the number of people who major in that were already English speakers, because India has many, many, many English speakers already.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe. So maybe. I mean, the focus of classes could be different. It could be like vocabulary of the UK, English. Vocabulary of the United States,
put
English.
A U in it. Put a U in it. Don't do that. Don't do those dirty Americans do. Don't
That's
delete
right.
that U in color.
That's right.
In labor. That's right.
That's right. Yes.
Okay. Well, I have one for you.
How do you spell fairy?
I still don't know the British spelling. Did you look it up?
It's like, no, I didn't, but I think it's F-A-E-R something.
There's an E after the A. That's right. Yeah. Okay, I have one for you. What country pays their primary teachers the highest salaries?
Ooh, I don't know the answer to this, but I do know the answer for which country spends the most per student in elementary education.
So oh, I'm going to go with education.
Okay. Do you want me to tell you? I can tell you the answer to that question, but it ruins that trivia question. Because that would be my guess. Is it a European country?
It's not. It's not a small European country.
So then we can. Yeah. Is it in Asia?
No.
Is it the
it's
U.S.?
It's in Europe.
It's in Europe?
No, it's in Europe. The U.S. pays a 10-year experienced teacher, primary teacher. They pay them on average $54,000. On average. Of course, they go.
Okay, is it Norway? Is it Norway?
States. It's not. It's Germany. Germany pays, on average, $73,500.
That is interesting because.
Yeah.
Okay, so which country spends the most per student per year on education, elementary education? And,
Since it's a small European country? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
This is 2019.
Is it Luxembourg?
That might be out of date.
Is it Luxembourg?
It is Luxembourg, and it is astoundingly different. So Norway is the second most with 18,000 per year. U.S. is 15,500 per year. Luxembourg was $25,600 per student.
It is
not even close.
No.
Not
that's a difference
close.
Of like – that's a difference of multiple MacBook Pros.
Begs the question, if it's not going to salaries, like, they must have the most beautiful grounds ever. Like, what is it going to?
I know, right? It is quite perplexing. What? Although, was that government spending or is that just total economic spending?
I don't know, Tim. It's a fat. I was looking up trivia questions for you.
Well, because
I was not doing deep dive in research.
The way that many economists measure education spending is total GDP, like a percent of GDP, which would include private expenditures.
So maybe divided by the number of children that. Oh, okay. Yeah.
So maybe there's obscene like
private
tutoring spending. Yeah, yeah. Going
yeah,
out.
Yeah. Get my kid in the best preschool.
Do you know that the country spends the most money per child to raise them total? Is South Korea?
Is it because they have like many, many very small families where all the resources are put into the child,
or no children? If you do have a child.
Does it count as spending on children if you're not?
Of course it doesn't. Like, that's one of the arguments about why people aren't having kids in South Korea is because they're like, hey, do you know how expensive it is? I think I read only 2% of South Korean parents surveyed do not pay for private tutoring.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy? Only 2% do not pay for private tutoring. That's like, that's insane.
Yeah, do you love your child?
And it was like, and if you don't do it, your child is just utterly just destined to fail. you have to do it. So there's like an extreme view on education and competitive-based education. So like the best tutoring, the best... Actually, I think a lot of it's like almost like CV building early on. Like, did you get into
it's meritocracy. Every step,
academy?
From what I understand, a lot of Asian education systems are meritocracies. I mean, to get into the next step, better programs, you have to have performed well in the previous step. So it's not just like for us, for in the U.S., most students aren't thinking about qualifying for something until high school. Until the end of high school, they're thinking about what college can I get into. But much, you know, as in my elementary school kids are not thinking like, what grades they get for the purpose of qualifying for a good middle school.
Well, maybe they should, Enoch.
Maybe they are.
Maybe you're not appropriately. I don't know.
Well, and when we visited I have family in Japan, and when we visited family, the kids were all going to a supplemental program before school. So they'd leave the home at like 6 a.m. and then they'd attend like a post-school supplemental education program, which was every day. And they wouldn't get home till like late dinner.
That is, it's interesting that I guess whole separate conversation about birth rates, but like competitive atmospheres for children lead to fewer children, perhaps.
I think that seems.
Yeah,
it seems very plausible.
But fertility rates are not our conversation today. Maybe a future conversation.
There we go. I got one more trivia question. You want one more?
Oh,
or are you done? Are you trivia
done? I want another
gifts.
One.
I've got gifts galore. Merry Christmas.
You can eat over here.
All you can eat. All right. So which country for teenage-aged students has the highest number of hours of homework per week based on survey data?
Oh, that sounds terrible. I do not want to live in this country. Because I think doesn't most research say that like hours of homework doesn't really have any correlation effect or any causal effect upon performance or upon like actual attainment? I don't know.
I don't know.
Okay, I know homework is a very mixed research area about Twix and has any effect at all. So I feel like I don't want to live in a country that gives you tons of hours of homework. So what country
better
has the most hours of homework per teenager in school? I'll say South Korea.
You're in the right continent.
Okay, so I wonder if tutoring counts, like separate private tutoring, which is like...
Yeah, I don't know if that would be homework.
Yeah, I know. I think it's a designated...
That's like extracurricular. That's like a bonus.
Hey, on top of the Philippines, 70% of my students were Korean, and like most of them, if not all of them, were also enrolled in academies, which would do completely different work. Like they were not working on assignments that I would give them in international baccalaureate economics. They were doing this like math drills. So anyway, if that doesn't count, then
I don't know if it counts.
I'll say Japan.
It is not Japan. Go bigger. Go bigger.
China.
I gave it away. It's China. So it's not just a couple kids. It's not just a couple kids in a tiny country. 14 hours a week, average.
Wow, that's a lot outside of the class time.
On top of attending.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you for these gifts. I appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome, Tim. You are welcome.
So
treasure them.
We've
learned.
Talked today.
Point of education.
I'm not sure how important it is, but I learned. So today we're going to talk about what should we value in education system. So we want to sort of blow apart the box of what we expect education to be. And maybe rebuild it up. Meaning, I think most people are like, oh, of course it's what you learn, because that's what I learned. But we want to talk about if all the things that a country could prioritize in their education systems, how do you determine what comes first? Because we have scarce time of students, so many minutes of students. And so how we decide, is it philosophy? Is it math? Is it laboratory-based science? Is it civics class? Is it some type of volunteering behavior? What are we going to put first?
Yeah, so this is interesting. The origins of this conversation came from experience living in Mexico. So in Mexico, the students here seem to have an unusually large focus on history relative to history in the U.S. Like the ability of students to know important dates or important historical events, both for Mexican history and also for U.S. history or for world history in general, is just far superior to the U.S. And it's a focus everywhere. It's a focus in the classroom design, but streets are named after important dates. We live on 20 de noviembre, which everything represents an important historical event. The when we go to cities, the statues represent historical events. The buildings that have been preserved are all like important historical buildings. So it's just everywhere. Like history. This isn't an academic thing. This is an experiential thing. but it seems to be the focus. Whereas in the U.S., it seems that there is a growing focus on STEM or STEAM topics, but there's a huge focus on like what is practical, what is going to help me land a job. Which, looking into it, according to Gallup poll survey data, is the primary reason students are choosing to go on to additional optional education after graduating from high school, is for job or for increasing income. Hmm. Also seems to align with the India statistic.
And so this is great. This is wonderful to bring us up, these distinctions. And it's funny, I think if you mentioned an American, well, a North American, probably as a U.S. citizen, a resident, this Mexican difference about history, maybe they would go, well, what's the point? Like, why? And in their mind, they probably may have the implicit conversational assumption of, for a job. What's the point for income? What's the point for...
Right. They wouldn't even have to state it. It's so fundamental to the cultural norm.
Yeah, and I think that you would be on the... If you were arguing for an important placement in history, you would be automatically on the defensive of like...
This in the U.S., in a U.S. context.
In the U.S., you'd have to be. Whereas I think me, perhaps, I don't know, I'm not in Mexico. Perhaps in Mexico, it's like, well, of course you learn history because how else can you know who you are?
Or totally. I think that's like a core part of it, is this question of like, who am I? In the U.S., like, you start talking about your job and what you do. And in Mexico, you talk about where you come from and that's who you are. So it's like there's a deeper reason, I think, for the answer, is that we need to like justify our worth by getting a good job and earning a high income. And that's kind of an answer to a more fundamental question that we don't explicitly ask, but it does seem to be core to our answer of the question of like, what do we prioritize in education?
So I'm gonna make the claim, and tell me if you think I'm right, Enoch, that I think in the United States, our emphasis upon education as job preparation and job eventual placement has been increasing throughout the 20th century until now. Do you think that's a largely correct claim? Okay.
Yeah, I think, so one thing I did was I went and looked at statements of answers to the question, what is the purpose of education in the 20th century. So from, I have a quote from like 1934, 1948, 1991.
Oh, please share.
You want them right now?
Yeah, actually I do. Because I have an appointment to make, so go for it, please.
Okay, so this is a quote from 1934. The purpose of education is to give the young the things they need in order to develop in an orderly, sequential way into members of society.
Mm. Okay, so 1948, jobs. Actually, this is important. I'm going to jump in here. Members of society, even now, I think many people interpret that and go, oh yeah, of course, to be contributing to society, i.e. job. But that members of society might mean not job. It might be just like fabric of society, right? Of like citizen, a social fabric.
That's right. It's much broader than just job. It's human being. Yeah. There's a great one. So like, actually, are you familiar with the Northwest Ordinance?
Oh, yes.
Not related to education. Did you look this up?
I did not know, but having grown up in Michigan, that's very, okay, very important for all the townships. Every township is divided into sections and one section is given to school. But keep going.
That's right. And so there's a focus on education or on setting aside land for education. But this specific quote from the Northwest Ordinance, this is 1787, is religion, morality, and knowledge being necessary to give good government and the happiness of mankind, schools and the means of education shall forever be encouraged. So like the explicitly stated purpose of education in 1787 of the education system includes religion and morality in addition to knowledge. Like, I feel like those first two have been, you know, if you said, well, what's the purpose of the Michigan public education system? You wouldn't find many people whose first response would include the teaching of religion for the happiness of mankind and for good governance.
No. But it was fascinating, though, is that we've lost track of this, but that was the large part of the antiquity origins of education, was the moral formation of a person. We might now call that, I think we easily call that in the liberal arts, quote unquote, how to think. And different philosophical frameworks and who am I? What does it mean to relate to other people in society? But moral foundations, I think, is an important part of education. By the way, side note, Northwest Ordinance. So I think, if I remember correctly, the most central section within a township was dedicated to the schoolhouse. And so that was like given to public education. The most, by central, I mean geographically central. So no matter how far apart you lived in the township, you should be within walking distance, maybe long. Do you know that my father, Enoch, went to one of the last operating one-room schoolhouses in Michigan.
I did not. That's a great fun fact.
He did. Yeah, he did. In Yale, Michigan. So the town of Yale. So my dad would always love to say, you know, I graduated from Yale. I was like, stop it.
The one-room schoolhouse, so, Yale?
The town of Yale, Michigan. He went to one of the last operating one-room schoolhouses all of Michigan, I think through eighth grade. And so he had like one room.
9 years in the same room.
Now we would call that, I go, Dad, that's Montessori. Wow, that's so bougie.
You're avant-garde.
Yeah, exactly.
What to do all day.
Yeah, and part of the task.
My kids are in Montessori right now. It's pretty awesome. In Mexico, they're in a Montessori school.
Do they also have part of their origins? They have to go fill up the crock of water for the day for everyone to scoop out.
I mean, they do a lot of cooking. I mean, they cook stuff.
That's perfect. There you go. That's perfect. That's holistic. Holistic. All right. So keep
giving me rocks and tell me compliments when I go visit them.
You're going through the quotes. Keep going. I want to see this evolution.
Okay. 1948. Yeah. This is Martin Luther King Jr. at Morehouse College. He says, the function of education is to teach one to think intensively and to think critically. But education which stops with efficiency may prove the greatest menace to society. The most dangerous criminal may be the man gifted with reason, but no morals. We must remember that intelligence is not enough. Intelligence plus character. That is the goal of true education. Love it. It's powerful, right?
It's kind of cutting. Yeah.
It's cutting, yes. And I mean, it feels like a direct critique of public education, of U.S. education in 2024. Doesn't it?
I think very much so. Actually, it's funny. We'll tell you that lunch I had. It was quite fun. I was mentioning classical education, and the person I was talking to, she wasn't aware of the trends. I'm like, oh, it's growing in the United States. And I said, and she got excited. She goes, this sounds great. And I said, yeah. And she said, I hope it hits public schools. I said, I think it'd be more difficult. And she's like, why is that? I was like, well, you have to agree upon what is virtue to do that. And so in a way, I argued at least, and I think this is true, one of the reasons also to focus on job skills is the lowest common denominator. It's like, well, we might not agree that chastity, for example, is a virtue. We might not agree that how patience ought to look, or even fidelity. Like, for example, I think fidelity is really important, in particular in a marriage, for example. Not everyone agrees that. I mean, I have friends here in Scotland who have had public sanctioning, you know, as far as like being like, you know, silenced, because they've said from their positions as public leaders that they would not have, not even that others shouldn't have a child in a wedlock, that they would not have a child in a wedlock, but you can't say that. How can you dare cast moral judgment on others? Well, if we can't morally agree, well, at least we can say school should prepare you for jobs. Because I think the right
would be highly contentious if you were teaching a version of virtue that was, or if my students' teachers were teaching a version of virtue that I was completely at odds with, I would have serious problems.
100%. Which is the way going to this note, I do think one of the reasons why, when you think of the things that we fight about the most, our own local societies, about education curriculum, it's actually not STEAM issues. Not really. It's things like, for example, like, do you teach critical race theory in class? Because that's the whole who are we, right? Do you teach, what form of history do you teach in class? Do you teach America's great and can you do no wrong? Or do you teach America's awful and it's full of wrongs? Or do you, maybe my approach, which is, America is America and does both. But like those ways of how you teach the United States, history itself, we fight about it because it goes to our very core of who are we. And so if we can't agree at the beginning about who are we and what we're aiming for, well, at least you can maybe go to the lowest common denominator of skills and jobs.
Yeah, no, I think that's totally, I think that's totally right on. I think that I think it has a lot to do with the shift towards evaluating everything through the lens of GDP per capita. Like it's so not contentious and it's so easy to go to that it can be mistaken as the ultimate end when given enough years ago, nobody was thinking that increasing GDP per capita was the ultimate goal. Sure, it made a lot of other things easier and was a reasonable objective, but it wasn't like the reason to exist.
Yes. Actually, I feel like now I hear competing arguments about why work is good. Either it's work is great because it allows someone to contribute to society. In other words, the only way to actually be a good member or a good citizen is through paid gainful employment, which I have problems with. Or it might be an argument of I find my own identity through my work. Like I find my own fulfillment, sense of purpose through my paid labor, which I also have problems with. But both of those are very different competing ideological frameworks and different paradigms for work that still at the end of the day would say work is the end. Work is the goal.
Yep. Yeah. And it's very different. No. I just have one more, and it's actually really good. It's 1991. The one continuing purpose of education since ancient times has been to bring people to as full a realization as possible of what it is to be a human being. Other statements of educational purpose have also been widely accepted. Those are to develop the intellect, serve social needs, contribute to the economy, or create an effective workforce, to prepare students for a job or career, promote social or political systems. These purposes offered are undesirably limited in scope. In some instances, they conflict with the broad purpose I have indicated. They imply a distorted human existence. The broader humanistic purpose includes all of them and goes beyond them, for it seeks to encompass all the dimensions of the human experience. And this is under a title of in an essay called The Curriculum Matrix, Transcendence and Mathematics.
Wow. Wow. This also brings in mind, too.
Go ahead.
I'm surprised you didn't read the quote at all by David Foster Wallace in his speech, This is Water.
Can you give it?
I mean, he says everyone worships, but he basically says the beautiful part about he's giving an address, a graduation address to a university graduating class, commencement address. And he's saying that's what education is important. And he's saying education is important because it lets you see all these things around you. It lets you see the water swimming in. It lets you also realize that everyone does worship. And that itself is liberating. Now, of course, he goes on to, because I say, yes, everyone does worship. And therefore, let's all make sure you're worshiping the right thing. He's more like everyone worships. So make sure that you're worshiping whatever you think is the right thing. Which should be a little bit.
Well, he says a lot. He says a lot of things will destroy you if you worship them.
He does. Actually, you're right. He's not fully gone the way because he is saying there is such thing as effectively vice. If you worship power, don't worship power. Don't worship beauty. Don't worship money. You're totally right. He has all these things that you should not worship. But the point though is that speech at the end of the day though is saying education is meant to liberate oneself. And I'd say that at the end of the day, that's kind of what you're harnessing, Enoch. These quotes you're saying, education is meant for the liberation of the student. That's what it's designed for. It's designed for the formation, the moral formation that the person can be as they were intended to be. And they can be pursuing the good. And then education is trying to identify what is the good and what are the best ways to pursue that. And we've made it into efficiency.
Efficiency, yeah. I mean, no, this was astounding to me because, you know, how many times have you heard, the U.S. education system is falling, is deteriorating so quickly? And I'm not going to disagree with that statement, but then they'll quote something like, we're now 35th in the world or something, you know. And the question I have is what deity has, like, descended upon us that can tell us with with objective authority which country has superior or inferior education? And this presupposes that there's some objective that's measurable of education systems.
Yes, exactly.
And so what do you think they measure?
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, obviously they're doing, like, you know, math skills, but at the end of the day, they're all submitting to materialistic objectives that are easy to measure. And you and I both, I think completely agree with this, but, like, be careful what you measure because you will wind up pursuing the very thing you measure. And so if you start measuring
I think these measurements
they become the goals themselves, which is very, very unfortunate, very problematic. And you and I obviously we don't teach the humanities. So this is kind of a little bit of an unusual conversation because typically when people are having this conversation, they're oftentimes philosophers or professors of literature, and they're lamenting the way the world's gone. And they're like, those empirical people, they've taken all over. Well, you and I are both empiricists. We use empirical data. We both like to crunch numbers, and we both like to use spreadsheets. And yet, we have joined the fight, Enoch. We have joined the discussion.
Well, and I think as a kid growing up, like, if I was in a class and there wasn't an objectively correct or incorrect answer, I immediately dismissed it as less important. And now I don't think the same way at all. Like, I did. I was in math, econ, and computer science. Like, those were my areas.
I mean, to be fair, though, I think little children, especially little children, they do need to learn to, like, memorization. They're not quite as, you know, you have to develop the kind of ability to actually do, like, nuanced thinking. Like, for example, I don't tell my kids, right now I'm homeschooling my kids on parliamentary democracy in the UK. And so my older,
no, I'm going to
go ahead, disagree, please.
I mean, I don't think teaching things like how to share what the purpose of life is. Like, I think these conversations you can have young, like preschool.
I mean, that's a good point. I do that with my children. We do talk about.
I hope so. We're only, you're going to memorize until you're 15 and then we'll talk about morals, kids.
Just brutes.
You steal, vice, you know, whatever you want. Stay.
There's no separation. Well, here's what's
I can't you teach you know. Not to punch or kick. You're too young. You're bite not. Me.
Since you were in the world of economics. But there are some papers. And I have the citations, but who cares? We're on a podcast. But there is an overall finding that there's a huge impact of education. And it looks like a lot of the economic growth of the United States in the 19th century, the 1800s, can be attributed to mass participation education. So, like, it might be as low as 20% or as high as 33% or one-third of GDP growth is because of education. Because of educational attainment and the public exposure education, going from, like, the elite to all, that perhaps that was part of upwards of one-third of the GDP growth was from just that.
Which, well, of course it was, but that begs the question.
Well, actually,
that begs the question is, like, is that was measuring the right thing?
Well, most are like, oh, that must mean they had job preparation. Well, look at the quotes just read. The quotes from the 1800s had nothing to do with job preparation. Like,
well, but
all.
They include, I mean, literacy, basic, like, arithmetic, like, basic mathematical skills, like, all of this stuff is going to contribute.
Yes. Actually, whether as I point, though, I don't think you have to say, I want this or that. I think actually this is one of the rare examples where you can say, great, I want to do a holistic education and it will also lead to the economic welfare gains of my country.
Sure. You don't have, but you do have to make trade-offs. And you can, like, in Mexico, they make a lot more space for history, and that comes at a cost of other subjects. And at the U.S., okay. Like, we are abysmal, at least I am individually abysmal at history, and it's because I've focused on a lot of other topics. So you can say you want everything you want all you want, but Tim, you are a curriculum dictator, and you get to choose, you know, you get to choose your top three priorities, and after that it's going to go to somebody else is going to take over, but you get first shot. Like, what three topics are you including in your curriculum?
Man, these are
or
questions.
Areas of study.
I mean, of course, this is such a hard thing to answer in a vacuum, because I have to ask all these questions about context. Like, am I in a homogenous society that we actually have?
You're in 2024 U.S. They've just switched away from democracy. Although you could have democracy be one of the goals, but at least in the education system, it's just dictator Tim, authoritarian Tim.
Okay, you know what? I would prioritize. Still, I still want math my top three. I still do.
Okay.
I still do. I to be honest, I'm less keen on how we currently do science in our system, because, like, it's more about just learning facts that necessarily. I mean, I can tell you about electron valence, and I don't know why. It's unclear to me why. I can tell you about periodic table of elements because my teacher made us memorize it, which always confused me by having to memorize an entire periodic table of elements. I do think there's a purpose to learning scientific thinking, which was not really taught to me. So to be fair, I would redesign that. But scientific thinking, like causation, and how experimentation actually works. But I think I would put into my top three, Enoch, what has currently been pushed down over time, I'd put in there what we largely call civics.
Okay.
I'd put it back in my top three. We still have civics, in name only. Oftentimes, civics at this point has been reduced to financial basic 101s, which to me is mind-blowing that somehow the class called civics or civic virtue or citizenship has now gone into how to balance a budget. How to create a fake budget. I remember in my civics class when I was in high school.
Don't be a drag on the economy, man.
Oh, you don't be a drag on the economy. Don't you dare go to that welfare office. Don't you dare do it. It's there, but only as a safety net. Don't you fall into it. Like, I still have a vivid memory of my high school teacher talking about how to buy a used car and put your hand against the muffler to see if there's a black ring in your hand. I was like,
probably more use. Wait. Which have you used more since then? Valence of. Never mind. I don't.
I know. We should talk about electron.
So, we gotta stop.
wait, it's fascinating. Actually, Scotland, they still have
civics. You have civics and mathematics. You got room for one more subject.
Oh my goodness gracious. I mean, civics, I'm gonna include philosophy in that. Okay, so like, I think civics should be taught like a moral philosophical viewpoint. So I'm gonna put all that in there together. And I think actually you can also include in my world of civics a form of my own area of politics. I think you could actually talk about your own system and like democracy.
Squeeze as much into your singular topic as possible, man.
Well, I mean, civics,
I want to teach everything. I'm going to call it civics. I'm going to teach everything. I want everything, and I'll call it civics. And I got one more space.
Thank you. I also would include reading. How does that reading? I think
yeah.
Reading
no, I mean literacy. Literacy
important. Yeah, I think literacy is really important. If I have a system which my kids can do brilliant math, and they're really good citizens, they have no idea how to read or write, I think that's problematic.
I mean, the MLK Jr. quote, though, is striking. Like, if you just get reading and math and you don't get morality, you got some monsters on your hand.
You do. Yes. You really do. Which I think we're kind of there, but, it's odd how we're there right now. But Enoch, you asked me the question. Let's walk through it. You kind of blinded me. I'm about to go through it. What are some things I want you to nominate one category, one discipline to be in your top three?
So I mean, I think I've got the same. I think I want to get literacy.
Yeah.
It's funny because we're talking across the spectrum of education. Like literacy is like the entrance ticket to so many other disciplines. But it's foundational and fundamental. So being able to maybe mastery of language to some extent, which we're sounding pretty classical. Yep. And I'm going to go with mathematics too. Like,
and so mastery of language would also include speech,
like rhetoric, speaking.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
By the way, do you know that I'm
doing this thing now three times a week where I join grad students for work time. We have to do what's called the student's prayer. It's like some liturgy. It's hundreds of years old. And part of it is help me communicate persuasively, but also with charm. I like that.
Oh, wow.
Like, with charm. It's like,
form,
yes.
Form and function.
Actually, exactly. It's like, help me communicate. You can say it persuasively is effectively, but I love it, the add of charm. And to me, I'm like, yes, like, help me be humble. Because that charm includes humility.
It almost sounds dangerous, though, like, doesn't it? Like, it's so, like, to trick people. But
it does.
But I agree.
I think
aesthetics matters.
I don't think actually.
And
not...
beauty matters, right? Beauty is valuable as an end.
Yeah, like, I mean, how many times have you heard someone communicate an idea that you're like, well, I just think you're being a jerk. Like, I don't care your idea because I don't like you. And I think that you're being arrogant. I think you're being dismissive. You know, it's whatever it might be.
Totally.
Yeah.
It matters. Form matters.
Form matters. Okay. So you have.
And I think the last. So last thing, I do want like more morality or virtue, but like you said, it raises. If I didn't get any choice over the instructor and their prior beliefs on what morality or virtue encompass, I could easily see myself being horrified with the instruction for my children, and I'd almost choose rather not to have virtue formation by a random instructor than have it included in the school system. And yet, I've been so moved. I've had my needle moved so far on this question, but I do think like reading classic works in an attempt to answer the question, what is it to be human, is a, like reading timeless and really, like work that has stood the test of time in attempts to answer the question of what it is to be human and what is a good life and like, what does it mean to live well? I think there you're not gonna come to like reactionary pieces that are so relevant and of the moment that they are extremely biased, but they're gonna at least awaken within the reader's acknowledgement that the question is important, and I think maybe that would be my third category.
So you would safely assign.
So I didn't get civics, but maybe civics would be in the process.
I mean, civics is kind of what you're getting at, though. But you're saying like you would the mechanism by which doing it, you would safely assign great text with no teacher commentary.
Yeah.
Just say, here you go, kids.
No teacher. I mean, no. I want everybody to wrestle with it, but the primary instructor is the text itself, and then the facilitator is the teacher, which is of course going to bias things heavily.
Yeah.
But I do think that you can't encounter the works without at least, I mean, and I'm fine with that. Like, I don't want my kids to only come to instructors who think exactly as I do. Like, I want them to have diversity of thought, but I want my version of virtue to get a shot. And of course, I want to bias it heavily in my house because I think it's right and I love my kids.
So I agree with you. But I think that actually, so now we had our nice time of lamenting moral formation and education. I actually think it's still there. I don't know if you can fully get rid of it because that's what we fight about. We fight about, is a school even acknowledging Pride Month? Or is a school acknowledging Pride Month, for example? Like, these are things that we fight about at the local district level because this is effectively a fight over about moral formations and about what are the moral frameworks we're trying to instill in our children. And we're trying to say,
no, so it's always going to happen. It's always going to happen. I want it to be explicit.
Yeah.
Actually, I don't want it to be something.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's interesting. It's like, I actually think when you make things explicit, you actually have better dialogue on them because then you can actually say,
totally.
Yeah. Like when things aren't explicit, like for example, this is totally, don't worry, just follow my train of thought, I'll get there. But the Indian Constitution actually has a provision in it that allows the executive to declare civil liberties are now suspended. So there's a way that you can constitutionally say there's a grave emergency, usually during a time of war, there's a war going on, therefore, I as the executive am declaring grave emergency, and I am reducing civil liberties, like freedom of speech and the press. In the U.S., we cannot do that. The president is not capable of ever reducing freedom of speech or reducing freedom of press, but they still do it. Right? So World War II, for example, we saw the internment of American Japanese citizens. In Civil War, Abraham Lincoln threw a alleged Confederate in jail for what he was writing. We do that, but the problem in the United States example of Abraham Lincoln, you have to say that you are still following civil liberties. You have to say like, oh, no, it's still fine. I didn't. Like, there's nothing to see here. So you're playing this weird game where if someone calls you out, they say, hey, you suspended civil liberties. Instead of cutting to the actual conversation points of, was it worth it? You're saying, no, I'm not. Whereas in India, you can actually say, all right, you've declared grave emergency. We're now going to have a conversation about, was the emergency grave enough to merit
warrant the cutting of.
Exactly. So I think what you're saying, Enoch, is that if you actually explicitly have moral foundation instruction in school, you can have a conversation around moral foundation instruction in school, as opposed to saying, this is not moral foundation. This is about something else.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think I'm with you.
I agree with you.
I'm with you. And cause I don't think we can escape moral foundation. As a matter of fact, I would argue, and actually there's court cases that would confirm this, part of education is to socialize the young person into what it means to be an adult in this society you're in. So can I give you a legal case, Enoch?
Please do. Please give me a legal case, Tim.
I was hoping you wouldn't say no. No, I don't want to hear it. So I think I might have actually shared this with you before, maybe just like in conversation. Switzerland, they have a rule.
Favorite case study example.
It really is. It's great because how it blows American minds.
Those cantons.
Yes, keep using it. Switzerland has a rule that part of education, you have to learn how to swim, and you have to learn how to swim together. I've told this story before, haven't I?
You have to, but tell it again.
Yeah, tell it again. So,
Papa, tell us the story again.
Keep going again. So you have to learn how to swim, and it has to be in a co-ed setting. And there was a family from Turkey that had two girls, and they said, it's against our religious freedom to have our girls swim in a mixed setting with boys. And so they bring the court case up to the Swiss court. The Swiss court actually rules on behalf of the public school and says, sorry, tough luck. They go to the European Human Rights Court because there's actually such thing as European Human Rights Court. It goes to them, and they also rule, sorry, in their decision, they write, yes, the family's religious liberties are being violated. However, it's pretty small, and the school has made accommodations to let them wear, for example, burkinis. And they say it is the right of the school to integrate the immigrant family into society. In other words, you have to become Swiss. And part of education and part of the school is to actually make you or teach the young people how to become Swiss. Another example of this, still in Switzerland, another one, is a boy, a 15-year-old boy in this case. This is important because his age. He's 15 years old. He's a son of an imam from Syria. And he refused to shake the hand of his female teacher. And he said, I cannot do that. In my own religious context, I'm only allowed to touch female family members. I cannot touch a non-female family member. And so the initial provision was fine. That's okay. However, that means you also can't shake the hands of male teachers because that would be gender bias. And then politicians got a hold of this case. They said, whoa, whoa, we have a big issue with this. Like, what kind of, are we going to let a kid not shake the hand of a female teacher or not shake anyone's hand? Because part of being Swiss is both gender equity and the shaking of hands. And so this was a huge to-do in Switzerland. But the whole point is that these are screaming examples of part of school is to train young people in what it means to be a citizen in that context. In the Swiss example, they're explicitly saying you have to leave behind your previous cultural heritage in some cases and now adopt the Swiss cultural heritage, which itself, these examples are kind of un-American.
Totally. But it's astounding in our context. But
they're very Swiss, right?
But they're very Swiss.
They're very Swiss.
And there's a diversity of thought in the world, and it's kind of a beautiful thing.
Yeah. So you want to have some explicit moral instruction, but you are hesitant about who is doing that instruction.
Well, I don't think that I get to dictate every single thought that is taught, and nor do I think that, like, even if I was current dictator, I think dictatorships have the potential to be amazing. It's that they also have the potential to be absolutely, absolutely horrible that makes them less desirable than democracy in general. So, like, if I could choose every single topic taught, I would, of course, be in favor, but I know that other people would be horrified by what I would think would be fine to teach. And so how do you include moral formation in such a matter that's also palatable or acceptable to, if not everybody, the majority in the education context? And that's one thought. That's one attempt.
Yeah, it's a very challenging thing. I think what we've sort of settled upon, at least in the United States context, is local school districts have quite a bit of autonomy. And so therefore, they get their own decisions about what they teach. That's one way. And of course, there's also private school opt-outs, which are difficult because not everyone can opt out equally. Both in terms of financial resources for the family, but also geographic dispersion. Some areas just don't have very good opt-out opportunities. There are no perfect solutions.
There's no perfect solutions.
And I'm with you, too. Like, I want moral... I know in Scotland, they require a moral philosophy class to be taught to every high schooler. It's required. It's like, yes, you want to raise your hands and go, yes, you have an explicit religious moral philosophy class. But there's two problems. Is that one, Scotland is really quickly becoming post-Christian, which means that class has now turned explicitly in curriculum to world religions. So it's gone from religious philosophy of basically Church of Scotland, which would have been when it's first established, to now a comparative instruction of world religions. And second, this is of course what I'm hearing from Scottish individuals, is that it's so under-prioritized that the instructors oftentimes don't even know what philosophical frameworks are. They have no instruction that they received. And also no one cares. And so you have this crazy high variation on instruction, both in terms of content and in terms of quality.
But there I disagree with you. I think that's right. I think that's true. I mean, I'm not disagreeing with the statement or the example. But I do think there's a deep hunger for an answer to the question of, like, who am I and what am I here for? I think that it exists more and more in secular spaces because the current answers, I think, just so clearly don't satisfy. Like, I do think there's hunger to try to wrestle with these questions, but there's not clear appropriate spaces to do it. And the like historical, like, Christian or Catholic perspectives have been viewed as kind of like parochial and rejected. But there's still a hunger there to try to wrestle with these questions in a more intentional and thoughtful way. Like, nobody's going to be satisfied with crappy answers through an unorganized curriculum. But I think we all kind of feel that they're like, you know, I said I liked classes with right and wrong answers. I think that there are truly better ways to live and worse ways to live. Like, it's not just subjective and everybody does as they see fit. I think that there are answers to some of these questions, or at least there are swaths of incorrect answers. And I think wrestling with them does lead to, I don't know if the word progress is right, but a progression of thought or a maturity or a wisdom, an accumulation of wisdom. So there's merit to spending time on these topics, even if they can't be measured in, like, dollar income increase.
I agree with you. I think that, like, people do have a deep, deep desire for the greater questions. That's just innate. That's who we are. I don't think it'll ever go away. Mm-hmm. But I do think that, just to make it explicit, this conversation, you used the word secular space. For many people, that implies a space of neutrality, meaning that, like, it's almost an empty space. And there's this idea that many people, especially who are religious, have, that when society becomes post-religious, it now enters into this secular neutral space and a competition of ideas. I actually think that, like, there really isn't a neutral space. You can't approach it that way. And my neutral space, I mean, like, it's highly moralistic. And so, like, there's competing moral frameworks. One might be a Christian moral framework. It's funny. I came across a quote by C.S. Lewis recently that he himself was saying, he was speaking to people who were talking about England becoming post-Christian and becoming pagan. And he said, oh, if only it were so. It's like, if only it were so. Because pagan implies pre-Christian, which implies some kind of spiritualism that would be very susceptible, would be very receptive to Christianity. So I fear it would be much, much worse than that. It's going to become a post-Christian thing. It would be a new formation, not pagan. And I think that he's largely right. And I think that, like, if we do have these spaces that exist are completely non-neutral, and they are going to be competing moral paradigms. Is that what I mean by, like, I don't think it's easy.
But I think we get along fairly well kind of ignoring the questions altogether and just being like, well, increasing GDP is kind of a good goal. We can all get behind this one. And, like, we just kind of, like, kick the can of the really important questions down the road indefinitely, and then we die. You know, like, I think that if you scrape at it a little bit, I was astonished in grad school. I had a couple of times, I just started brushing the surface of topics related to religion. And I mean, most of my classmates were international students, but they were, like, super excited to talk about these questions of, like, why are we here and what is ultimate reality? And there didn't seem to be spaces for them that they felt appropriate for them to do that. And I think you're right. Like, I do think the public, like, quote unquote, neutral spaces are highly not neutral, or at least not places. You can't ever say what you think because you might offend somebody else. So they're just like silenced spaces, but they're not neutral spaces. But I think there's a hunger for spaces where you can really wrestle, and you're free to wrestle, and you're free to disagree or agree with any of the prevailing, like, moral frameworks. And I think there's a hunger there for that. I think there is a desperate shortage of that.
Yes. I think there's a definite hunger there as well. And I think it's funny because, like, but my bet, though, is when you're trying to teach moral frameworks and we'll call civic virtue, obviously, though, if you're doing Enoch, you have a particular framework you would like to persuade upon your students. I have a friend who's at Duke, and, you know, he said when he teaches, like, undergrads, he assigns them Martin Luther's essay, How to Love Your Enemies. And I heard one time a colleague kind of confront him and say, you're just teaching Judeo-Christianity to your students. And he was like, uh-huh, that's right. He was like, that's right. He's like, but I'm doing it without them knowing it. And they're like, that's, and it's funny. That was the problem. They're like, that's the worst thing of all. You're doing it implicitly and they're not aware you're doing it. And he's like, yeah, I'm doing it implicitly. And I'm
so
doing
then
it.
They have to accept it or reject it on their own and its own merits.
No, he's
which
like,
is
I'm
like
doing
the
it
best,
because
right?
I'm doing it on the civic heroism of Martin Luther King Jr. He's like, you're sure. Right. I am literally assigning a sermon, like him being a pastor. I'm assigning the reverend in this case, but they're reading it as the civic hero. And so because of that, they're easily persuaded. And the thing that was so offensive to a fellow academic was, but they're not really fully consenting because they have to have informed consent. And you're not really informing them that this is actually a Christian pastor. And his response was, well, yeah, they're 20 years old. They're at Duke. They should have figured that one out.
Filth.
What I do, it's funny because I wonder, Enoch, how long is he sort of teaching this moral infusion on the afterburners or the still present aroma of a Christian framework that's still on these students, and how long that lasts? Will it be a whole another paradigm that replaces it? I don't know these questions. I do think we can't escape morality. We're going to be having different competing moral frameworks. And I agree with you. I would like to have a class that explicitly names it. And maybe can actually have these big question conversations in which it's not me trying to batter my opinion to my students per se, but the students can actually have conversations that are making them think about these bigger questions. Why am I here? What's the point of all this? Who am I? So let me ask you this question. We're almost out of time here. If you could wave your wand and allocate more resources. Because you mentioned to me, earlier that Mexico spends more in anthropology. Is that right?
Per capita, yeah. As a share of their GDP, than any other country.
So we actually walked through that one. I thought that was fascinating.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, I think the answer to the question, like, who are we is where do we come from? But this question of who are we is, like, deeply important, and it can't be answered through just what you do. So, and now I'm, like, extrapolating, so I might be interpreting incorrectly, but there's just a heavy focus on anthropological study, and there's a deep desire, like, the U.S. historically basically eliminated the majority of the indigenous population, right? Like, it's not like, and there's not, and even today, there's reserves, but there's not, like, tons of integration. But the majority of Mexico is mestizo, or a mix of indigenous and Spanish, like, heritage. And so, like, uncovering this distant pre-Spanish past, it feels very important to answering the question, like, who am I and where do I come from? And, like, what am I comprised of? And so, like, there's just a great appreciation for, like, every mound contains, like, thousands of years of history, and underneath that mound there might be, like, drawings and art and beliefs and customs that are relevant to answering the question of who I am. And I think that in the U.S. we think we answer that question by, like, what's my job title and what will be next year, and, like, here's my 5 reports and here's what's on my CV.
Yes, I think you're right.
And so we have as enthusiastic an attempt at answering the question, and we're, like, passionate about answering the question. We just think that the answer is found in a different, you know, ladder.
You know, one time I was at my first year in grad school, earning my doctorate. I asked the professor, like, hey, I want to know a little more about you. Anyway, we can read my CV. And right? He was dead serious.
No,
right? Read my CV. It's like, yeah. I am my work achievements. And I was like, yes. I was like, okay.
This is me.
And I never asked that question in any form ever again. Because I was like,
it can be a little depressing. Huh?
I go to the public CV. And I think there was a sense, to be fair, that person, that was a good person. I think that there's also, I sort of unintentionally violated, this is a separate conversation, that line between personal and professional.
No, Tim, who are you?
I didn't do it that way. I hope I'm more soul than look, Kim, you know, I'm in your class. I'm sitting at your feet to learn, but who are you? But still, though, you did basically say, you want to know more about me, read my CV. That's it. Like, I am my achievements as it relates to my work. And I do, So let me ask this question as we're kind of ending near the end. If you could wave a wand and dedicate more resources toward your overall economy, toward a particular discipline. So I mean holistically. I mean, like, so earlier the question is about what would you prioritize?
Oh, I think,
like, public education. I mean, like, professors, jobs themselves.
I think intentional spaces of, like, relational interaction with other people. I think we need a ton of practice at that and a ton of intentionality at that. Like, how to be a good human being and how to interact with other human beings live.
And not escape conflict if it arises. Actually, have
not escape conflict.
It.
Yeah, have the conflict. No phone. Like, you can't escape into your phone. You can't, like, have some prior appointment. You just got to sit in the room with all the other uncomfortable people.
So you want to take everyone in the United States and force them to live in dormitories for 2 years.
There you go. Yeah, there's one. There's one version of that spending bill.
That's one. All right.
Here's my plan, everybody.
Not necessarily. So yours is, like, social learning.
Yeah, I think our EQ is lagging far behind our. I don't know if IQ is the right word, but our knowledge.
Good. I like that.
How about you? How about you, Tim?
Well, I mean, you went outside the box. I'm tempted to go outside the box as well now. That was a good answer, Enoch. I like it. I'm a little envious. I mean, I always joke around that, like, I think that every member of Congress should be required to take a crash course in economics. In particular, to be like,
oh, yes.
Trade-offs exist.
Oh, yes.
Like, that's it. Just trade-offs.
Yes, you don't have to go far. Right? You can do a 4-week crash course on where prices come from and that every decision is saying no to something else.
Exactly.
If you could understand that.
Yeah.
Actually, even if you could appreciate that.
Prices would be good, but I mean, it's more like trade-offs. It's just
opportunity cost.
Yes.
You just want opportunity cost.
Yeah, it's like, if you do more of that, then...
You're saying no to everything else.
So I think I'm tempted to say, I get, that's not quite how we think. Like, because most economics now, as you know, most professional economics is quantitative analysis and causal identification. And so, like, I don't really need
No,
more
you just need
that.
Principles and macro.
Yeah, just like, hey.
Micro, principles and microeconomics.
You can't have it all.
How to think like an economist.
Yeah, you can't have it all.
Can't have it all.
I actually think I mean, I guess my friends at my friends in other offices than me would be very happy to hear me say this, I guess. But I suppose philosophy, like some actual like pondering of questions that don't have easy answers and are not easy to measure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because like, and I don't need a lot of it. I'm not saying I want philosophers everywhere, but like I want more than we currently have explicitly in our education system, which might be zero. So like more than zero.
No, not zero. We got one. We've got a colleague.
Oh no, I meant mandated like K-12. Like you can graduate from high school and I think in almost any high school
and never
States,
have read any yes.
Yeah, never be exposed to it. Can't really. I wasn't exposed to it. I mean I was exposed to like other things. I guess I would say I was exposed implicitly to philosophy, but not explicitly. So that'd be my answer, I think.
Yeah.
Although yours is pretty good.
All right, good.
The social
No, we've
got EQ is pretty important.
Okay, I gotta exit. I've got an exit topic. I just thought it would be fun to like to look at how a couple other folks have decided to evaluate the education system across countries. I just thought this was interesting. So like I think I mentioned Business Insider report evaluates the education system across countries and their only two criteria are math and science attainment. So, you know, different countries' education system is rated exclusively on their math and science attainment, which is in itself like a value judgment. This was interesting.
And easier to
there
measure.
It's very easy to measure. Yeah, much well, maybe not very easy, but easier. There's a global citizenship education evaluation, and it includes all. It's a lot more holistic. It includes like statistics about enrollment, access, literacy, math, but then it has this category called global citizenship values, and so the score that the country attains includes the teaching of democratic values, tolerance, international cooperation, and the degree to which respondents would answer affirmative to the question, I see myself as a global citizen, which just struck me as like, I'm sure very few people read the like small print. They're just like, we're number 6 or we're 25 or we're 192. I don't think many people actually read like what is being rated, but it struck me as just so extremely specific that I kind of loved it. Some committee had to sit there and say, like, what is valuable? Have the same conversation we're having.
That's so fascinating because also, like, there's so many ways that a person can manifest not being a global citizen, which I think is still healthy. I don't know. Like, if someone's like, I really like...
Oh, totally.
Yeah, like, I really like local preferences.
My specific home and my community.
I mean, I find the life
of my... I love everyone on my street. I never want to leave.
Yeah, I mean, like, when we were at some old spot, like, taking photos next to a river in some mountains... A couple that was clearly rural and clearly working class, vaping and whatnot, and just talking, but very social, talking to us and cussing up a storm when they were speaking English, but also Gaelic. I was like, oh, that's interesting. And I was like, I bet you they would score low.
You know Gaelic cuss words?
I knew when they translated them for me.
But like, can you translate that verbatim?
I mean, like, in a weird way, it's like, if you have a proclivity to speak your national tongue, it's like hyper localized. Does that mean you're not a global citizen? It seems kind of a little.
Yeah. Or if you said like my family has lived here for 6,000 years, that's kind of powerful.
Yeah. Or say like I don't know. That measurement I find to be a cosmopolitan moral framework. Put that way.
Yeah. Totally. I mean, no. It's just laden. Like we're all answering the question, what should we value? We just might never have been explicit about it.
Yes.
And so I think it was a fun conversation, Tim. Thanks
oh, man,
having
I love it.
I think it helps me choose better.
Are you
going
to choose not for your kids to go to a classical education curriculum school?
I mean, I'm more and more persuaded every day. I kind of love our local public school. It's pretty
You know
great.
What? There's a trade-off but, between like the curriculum of actual like, learning and, as you said, the social interaction, because there's something beautiful, too, about maybe having a curriculum. I don't know if I like my public school's curriculum the best, but I love the fact that like there's a shared community aspect going on.
And totally. That's beautiful. There's no free lunch.
Trade-offs. There it
opportunity
is.
Opportunity cost.
Full circle back to choosing and knowing what you're giving up and you're choosing better.
All right. Thanks, Tim.
All right. Next time.